Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. My guests today are Keith Hampton, a professor of communication at Rutgers, who looks at the effect that technology is having on our social networks. And then, at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Hugo Bonin, who is with the Quebec Student Associations. Before that, some observations on time use and leisure, topics that come up in passing in my interview with Keith Hampton that we'll hear in a few minutes. You frequently hear it said that the reason that Americans are politically disengaged and do things like eating a pizzolo, new from Pizza Hut, a rolled hot sandwich intended to be held in one hand, while driving instead of sitting down to a nice meal with friends and or family, is that they just don't have the time. This is one of those clichés that looks to be untrue. Every June, the Bureau of Labor Statistics releases the results of its American Time Use Survey. It's drawn from a survey of over 13,000 people. That's more than 10 times the size of your typical opinion poll. Participants are asked to keep a diary of their activities on one assigned day of the week, and responses are blended into a national average. Of course, averages are averages. There can be lots of variations under the surface. But this is about as solid a picture of time use as you're going to get. A warning, there are a lot of numbers in what follows. I'll round and approximate and draw conclusions to make it easier for radio, but numbers do go with the territory. So how do Americans spend their time? They apparently don't lack for sleep. They spend more than a third of the day, almost 9 hours, in the arms of Morpheus. Women get 12 minutes more shut-eye than men on the average day. Americans spend an average of 3.5 hours working for pay, 4 for men, 3 for women. But that's because the headline averages mix together those working for pay with those not working for pay. Just looking at the employed alone, they spend just under 8 hours a day, a little over that for men, a little under for women, on the job. They had an average of 5 hours a day of leisure, just over for men, just under for women. Employed men get about 45 minutes a day more leisure than employed women. There is a second shift, but it's well under 8 hours long. Americans spend more than half their free time watching TV, close to 3 hours a day of it. Sports and recreation take up about 20 minutes of the average day, socializing less than half an hour, eating and drinking a bit more than an hour, shopping a bit less than an hour. Obviously, weekdays are different from weekends. There's an hour more sleep on average, more household tasks, more shopping. Surprisingly, for such an ostentatiously pious culture, worship doesn't take up as much of a weekend day as you might think, only about 20 minutes. That number is deceptively low because only 15% of the population reports religious or spiritual activities on a weekend day. Those that do devote 2.5 hours to it, but since 85% of the population devotes 0 hours, that brings down the average dramatically. Americans don't spend much time with their friends. Even on a weekend, just 43% report engaging in socializing. Those that do socialize spend 2.5 hours hanging out and such, but the rather low rate of participation brings the average down to just over an hour. But man, do Americans watch a lot of TV. 2.5 hours on the average weekday, over 3 hours on the weekend. Americans spend less than half an hour a day reading, women a bit more than men, weekends a bit more than weekdays, and about that much time relaxing and thinking as well. They spend another 20 or 30 minutes a day poking around on the computer, and about 30 to 45 minutes on sports and recreational travel. Children matter a lot for leisure. If they're under 6, they knock about an hour and a half off the average serving of leisure for their parents. Once they get past 6, parents get back about a half an hour in leisure. But even with kids in the picture, the difference in leisure between the sexes is smaller than you might guess, about half an hour. There are gender differences in leisure, don't get me wrong. For family with kids under 6, women spend just over 2 hours a day caring for them, compared with just over 1 for men. And there are, of course, gendered differences in housework. Almost half of women do some housework on the average day, compared with just a fifth of men, and women spend more time on it, close to 2 hours, compared to men's just over 1. Women are also more likely to do food preparation and spend more time at it, but here again, the differences are smaller than you might guess. Women do just over an hour, and men just under. It's a long way from equal, for sure, but it could be worse. Contrary to some stereotypes, leisure decline as income and educational attainment rise. Those who don't graduate from high school have an average of 6 hours of downtime a day. With a bachelor's degree or higher, that declines to just over 4 hours. American workers face a lot of problems, but the time crunch seems exaggerated. There's something in the society that makes people want to spend 19 hours a week watching TV. Back after a musical break. That was some of How to Tell Yourself from a Television by Erase Errata. We are the reason for your gated communities. Love it. My first guest is Keith Hampton. Hampton, along with his students Lauren Sessions and Unja Herr, has done research into just what all our electronic devices are doing to our social ties. To listen to the worrywarts, they're turning us into demented isolates. Hampton, a professor of communications at Rutgers, is here to tell us otherwise. Keith Hampton. Welcome, Keith Hampton. First of all, let's start by exploring why the level of social isolation or the richness of social networks is important.
Oh, absolutely. So we could look at this a number of ways, whether it's close social ties or the diversity of people's social ties. We know that good networks are associated with everything from good health to help getting a job to coping with social problems and access to a wide range of social support and resources.
And how are we defining social networks?
Well, social isolation and social networks are very different things. Social isolation is usually defined as either having no close social ties, or some people also define it as just not being very involved in kind of voluntary, kind of civic and civil activities. Whereas social networks is the connections that exist between us. So people who have great social networks in terms of the diversity of their social ties may still be very isolated if they have, say, no close relationships or they're not involved in kind of civic and civil activities.
This issue entered popular discourse through Putnam's Bowling Alone business. How does that fit in with this, the kind of work you're doing?
Absolutely. So that's certainly one half of this debate. Putnam was very concerned of kind of a decline in civic and civil behaviors, everything ranging from volunteering to whether you're talking to your neighbors. And then the other side of this debate kind of entered a few years ago with some work that came out of the U.S. General Social Survey by the work of McPherson, Smith-Levin, and Brashears, who at the time were at University of Arizona and Duke, and they found that the number of close relationships that Americans have has really declined over the last 20 years or so.
Yeah, tell us more about, I know these are not your findings, but this is an important background, so what exactly did they find?
Well, what they did is they compared a survey question from the 2004 General Social Survey with the 1985 General Social Survey, and the question that was asked was, when you look back over the last 6 months, who are the people with whom you discuss important matters? And unlike a lot of survey questions, people actually give a real name in response to those questions, or a series of names, up to five, actually. And what they found was a spike in social isolation over that 25 years. So the number of people who reported zero, somewhere along the lines of tripled, and the average size of people's social networks shrunk from about 3 to 2 when we look at those really close social ties.
And the most common answer was zero, right?
Yes. In their survey, the most common answer was zero, yes.
And before we go on, just what is the General Social Survey? And I bet a lot of the listeners don't know.
Well, the General Social Survey is one of those kind of gold standard surveys that's funded by the U.S. government and is completed, I believe, every 2 years now. And it's a survey where they literally fly to randomly selected households across the United States and interview people in person very in-depth about a series of questions. And it gives us a snapshot of kind of American society over those intervals.
And now back to McPherson et al. What about the breakdown between relatives and non-relatives in people's among people's intimates?
Right, that's also right. So in addition to kind of a rise in social isolation and a decrease in the average size of Americans' core close social ties, they also found that most Americans no longer had someone who was non-kin in that close inner circle. That close inner circle was much more likely to consist just of family members than it did 20, 25 years ago.
And what was your explanation for this rather remarkable decline? I mean, it was, what, 20 years or so, and it seems like a major change in the social landscape in a relatively short period of time. What was the explanation?
Right. So I should stress again, this wasn't my study, but their explanation was that this was, you know, as you said, a very unexpected change for a relatively short period of time. And what they did is they looked at other kind of big events that had occurred over that 20, 25-year cycle. And certainly they pointed to things like the rise of home computing, the rise of mobile phones, the rise of the Internet as possible causes for that change.
And what about things like increasing stress from work, increasing economic insecurity, just a sort of a general perception that life has sped up over the last couple of decades?
Right. I mean, that is another possible explanation. In my own work, we're much more concerned with the possibility that it's related to mobile phone use or computer use. But I should also point out that there's really not a lot of evidence that Americans, say, have less leisure time they do today than 25 years ago, or that they are more stressed or working more hours. In fact, when we look at other studies in terms of time use diaries, there hasn't been a lot of change, and what change there has suggests that Americans today actually tend to have more free time and work fewer hours than they did in the past.
Yeah, now we're getting a little off topic, but this is, I've noticed this myself in looking at the time use studies, the idea that people have no free time these days is rather a gross exaggeration, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's always that way. I mean, I think that when you ask people, you know, do you think you have it rough today? They all say, oh, yes, much rougher than it was in the past. But that's the brilliance of things like time use studies, where you can actually record the amount of hours that people are spending doing different activities. And because we have such good time use diaries going back over time, we can look longitudinally at those and see that, in fact, people are reporting having actually more leisure time and working fewer hours than they did in the past.
Okay, and now on to your work. The McPherson et al. Did discuss in passing the possibility that what was driving their finding of increased isolation are electronic communications, internet, mobile phone, that sort of thing. They don't really go into much detail on that, but you did go into some detail. So tell us about what you did.
That's right. I mean, we were certainly, you know, as intrigued and surprised by this finding of kind of big-scale social change as they were. And we wanted to try and narrow down the possibilities of what might be behind that change. So in 2008 and then again in 2010, in partnership with Pew Research and Lee Rainey at the Pew Internet Project, we interviewed a random sample of Americans about their core networks and about their different uses of technology. So we interviewed people who don't use the Internet, people who use the Internet a lot, people who use Facebook, people who use as many different technologies as we could possibly find.
Now, just a second. At this point, how many people do not use the Internet or mobile phones?
Well, Pew came out with some new findings this week that suggest that now only about 15% of Americans don't use the Internet.
And mobile phone use is something in that order as well?
I believe the findings are similar, although there's something slightly different with mobile phone use in that those people who don't have a mobile phone, it's very common that they have at least one other family member who does. So they do have access to a mobile phone, even if they don't have one themselves.
Okay, and then carry on with describing your work.
Right, so we asked that same question that they asked in the general social survey. We asked, you know, from time, looking back over the last 6 months, who are the people with whom you discuss important matters? And when we compared our findings to the findings that came from the 2004 General Social Survey, we could not replicate that spike in social isolation. And there's been a lot of discussion about why that might be, but the kind of current consensus seems to be that there was a problem with the kind of data entry portion of the General Social Survey related to social isolation. And in both of our surveys, we weren't able to replicate that. In fact, social isolation looks about the same as it did in 1985. However, we were able to replicate that finding of smaller core networks and less diverse social networks?
The general social survey is done face-to-face and has a very high response rate, something about, around 70%, and the Pew stuff is done by phone with a very high refusal rate, only about 20 or 25% responding. Does that make a difference?
Maybe. The refusal rate isn't quite that high for Pew studies, I should say. The total participation rate, once you take into account all the people you call who don't answer their phones, is close to 20% or so. But of those you actually get on the phone, the participation rate is actually fairly high. However, the General Social Survey actually did conduct part of the last of that 2004 General Social Survey by telephone, and we were able to compare the responses to that same question by telephone on the General Social Survey and in person by General Social Survey and in telephone by Pew, and we found very few differences. And the fact that we could conduct that study twice in both 2008 and 2010 and come up with very similar looking distributions suggests that we probably weren't experiencing much of a bias as a result of the change in the interviews.
I'm speaking with Keith Hampton, who is a professor in the Department of Communication at Rutgers University. And another technical problem, the General Social Survey is a very long survey, takes about an hour or so to complete, and you were asking in your work just very specific questions that are done more quickly. Is there any possibility that that form would make a difference?
Well, that's true. I mean, our survey is much shorter than the General Social Survey by any measure. However, the General Social Survey that was conducted in 1985, one of the criticisms of the 2004 General Social Survey was that placing that important matters question further into the survey may have been the reason that they found that finding a social isolation or smaller networks, it could have been something to do with fatigue. So by placing our question earlier in the survey and having a smaller survey overall, it's likely that we looked more like that original 1985 measure than even the 2004 General Social Survey.
Okay, so back to your findings. So you find nothing like the dramatic increase in isolation or decline in the richness of networks than McPherson did, right?
Well, not exactly. We did not find the same spike in social isolation, which is the number of people who report having no one with whom they can confide in. However, we did replicate that finding of smaller and less diverse core networks overall. Well, what is interesting, though, is when we looked at current uses of technology, their use of mobile phones and Facebook and so on, we didn't find any negative relationships between the use of these technologies and either the size or diversity of your network. And in fact, many of the uses of these technologies are associated with a little boost either in the size or diversity of your core network.
Now, what about demographics? I mean, what are things like education and income or where one lives due to the presence or absence of social networks?
Right. I mean, those are very important things that we controlled for in our study. Certainly, measures like education and sex, for example, tend to be very strong predictors of both the size and diversity of your network. Those people who have more years of formal education, this is the strongest predictor of having both a larger and more diverse network overall.
And then what about differences between the sexes? The cliche is, of course, men, you know, suffer in silence and women are always talking to their women friends about their relationship problems. Is there anything like that in the social sciences?
Oh, absolutely. It's a well-known, consistent finding that women both have more close relationships. They know they have more close relationships, and men also know that women have more close relationships, absolutely.
The discussing, what was the phrasing of that, discussing problems with? How was the question asked?
Those people with whom you discuss important matters.
Okay, so what do we know about how people understand that?
Well, that's also a great question. There has been some work done on how different people interpret that question, and certainly within a society there is a lot of variation. So, for example, men are more likely to think that an important matter has something to do with politics, where women tend to think an important matter has something to do with relationships and social support. Fortunately, we know that this variation is probably fairly consistent over time, so it probably didn't affect our study too much when we're comparing historically.
And what about the diversities of people's networks? Are they more likely to talk to people much like themselves, and how's that changed over time?
Right, so we can look at this a number of ways. When we're talking about core discussion networks, of course, we're really talking about a network of one or two really close social ties. there's really not a lot of diversity there. And like I said before, what diversity there is certainly has declined over the last 20 to 25 years. But we have tried other ways of measuring the diversity of people's social networks. We've looked at the total size or the number of people that they know in total, their active social networks. And then we also look at the diversity of their total social networks by looking at the number of different types of people that they know.
And what about the quality of what is shared? I mean, I think perhaps there's a possibility that, that while people's social networks might have increased in size because of communications technologies, they may just be sharing what they have for breakfast and not their innermost thoughts and feelings. Do we know anything about the content?
Yes, very good question again. So we did ask people about their perception of how much social support they get from the members of their social network. And what we found was that people who use Facebook and Internet tend to report that they get more social support, particularly emotional support, from their network than other folks. And when we compare the kind of magnitude of those effects to known predictors like education, for example, or being married, it's not just a small relationship. So people who use Facebook a lot, say a number of times a day, on average, they report getting a boost in their social support that's equivalent to about half of the boost you get from being married.
And texting. People are, you know, of course, constantly texting. Does that have any effect on social ties?
You know, I imagine it does, but it hasn't really shown up in our studies of measuring core discussion networks or even in our studies that measure the diversity of people's relationship. It seems to be relatively neutral.
Are the technologies allowing people to replace ties with you know, people who might be their neighbors with ties, people who might be in Kathmandu?
Yeah, I mean, we don't exactly know. I mean, certainly we haven't seen a lot of replacement. I mean, so when we look at the size of people's social networks overall, not just their core networks, Internet users and people on Facebook, for example, they tend not to have any more or less friends than anybody else. However, when we look at things like local engagement, we also find that Internet users tend to be as engaged or even more engaged in the kind of local social milieus like neighboring and hanging out in public spaces and local restaurants and cafes.
Yeah, you did some work interviewing people in parks with Internet access, right?
That's right. We spent a lot of time sitting in 7 or 8 public parks located in the U.S. and in Canada. And we observed, I think, about 1,500 people using the Internet in those spaces and tried to understand how their life in those spaces was affected by their social networks and how their presence in those spaces may have been affecting other people there. And the general kind of finding was that certainly people on cell phones were less engaged with those who were around them, but people who were using their cell phones for the Internet or a laptop in those spaces were about as engaged as someone who was, say, reading a book.
So there are a lot of you know, old-timey social scolds who say that we're constantly tapping on devices and we're just more and more alienated and our social ties are fraying. You would say that these worries are somewhere between overblown and totally misplaced.
Well, I mean, it's certainly a delicate issue, and we wouldn't want to brush aside, you know, certain cases where we do see some kind of negative relationship for certain individuals in use of these technologies. I mean, certainly almost any technology can be abused, but there's a long history of, you know, associating new technologies with kind of the decline of civilization. I mean, everything since the invention of the bicycle to electricity has been associated with kind of decline of American morals. So it's probably not terribly surprising that we associate, you know, this new technology with yet another decline. But the empirical data really just doesn't seem to support that. I mean, the current uses of these technologies are either relatively neutral or positive on almost every measure of kind of civic and civil or political or social engagement that we could come up with.
Now, there's some worry that the echo chamber effect of people are more likely to hear opinions consonant with their own or more likely to be in contact with their own prejudices reflected back to them. Do you find any evidence for or against that?
We don't. In fact, what we do find is that if we look at people's use of these new technologies, everything from photo sharing to using blogging to using Facebook, and the diversity of their overall social networks, we find that those people who are using these technologies have more diverse networks overall, although the direction and the way that relationship works isn't as clear as we once thought, in that people who are using these technologies tend to be using public spaces more, they tend to be volunteering more, they're more likely to go to church, and these things are associated with more diverse social networks as well. So what we find is about half of the kind of effect of using these technologies on the diversity of your network comes from kind of this direct relationship, and the other half comes from just the relationship between using these technologies and using other kind of more traditional social milieus that we know are associated with having a more diverse network.
And I want to understand what you just said. You said people who use these technologies are more likely to be engaged in what they call meat space in the physical and social world than those who aren't, right?
That's exactly it. I mean, we find that, meat space and virtual space, they're not as independent as we once thought. And using these technologies tends to be associated with, engaging in these kind of traditional spaces as much or more than in the past.
I was Keith Hampton, a professor of communications at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Bach's Vom Himmel hoch, da komm ich her, From Heaven Above to Earth I Come, a set of variations for organ performed by Simon Preston. We'll hear Stravinsky's version of that at the end of the show. My next guest is Hugo Bonin, who is with CLASA, the province-wide association of student unions in Quebec. Students in Quebec are just coming off a long strike and series of street demonstrations protesting tuition hikes specifically and their neoliberal government more broadly. Among the government's responses to the demonstrations was to pass something called Bill 78, a piece of legislation designed to repress student protest. But the protests have nonetheless been huge and impressive, and here's Hugo Bonin to tell us how and why. Welcome. First of all, the student strikes over the last several months in Quebec have just been massive and very impressive, but haven't gotten all that much coverage here. So give us the background. What were they about? How did they get started?
Okay, so things started maybe 2 years ago when the Liberal government in Quebec announced that it would increase tuition hikes by 75%. At the time, the student movement took the streets in order to denounce that measure. Well, we petitioned in the government. We did several protests with tens of thousands of students in the streets. Eventually, the government didn't answer to our demands. So we had a general assemblies where we decided where the student union in each university and colleges decided to go on strike or not. Some did not. But the whole thing started since mid-February. And since then there's been, well, at the peak of the strike there was around 300,000 students on strike. But I would say the average has been around 150,000 students on strike.
Now, what about these unions you mentioned? Is there a student union on each campus?
Yes, there's a student union on each university and each campus. There's also a departmental student union in the universities. And a lot of the strikes started actually from those departments, mostly social sciences departments, art departments. And those student unions went on strike the first and were followed after that by science. And even in some cases, for example, business students went on strike for a week or so. And so that's at the local level. We have those student unions in the university and colleges. But there's also what we call a Quebec-wide student union, a provincial student union, which CLASS is one of them. There's also three others student unions at the Quebec-wide level.
Are there similar student unions elsewhere in Canada, or is this particular to Quebec?
No, there's a student union. Well, it's student association, student union, it depends. But it's there's in other universities across Canada, you have student union or student association. And you also have, on the Canadian-wide level, you have the Canadian Federation of Students, which is a student union also, but at the Canadian level.
What were the issues precisely? The tuition in Quebec is lower than elsewhere in Canada, correct?
Yep. Well, the issue is that the fact is that in Quebec, we have the lowest tuition in the country, and I would say North America, well, in Canada and the U.S. But one of the effects of those low tuition is the fact that in Quebec we have the most higher post-secondary frequentation rate than in Canada. So we have more students in colleges and universities because higher education is basically more accessible in Quebec. And we also have our student debt is really lower than the Canadian one or the U.S. one. And one thing also that the student movement has always been strong in Quebec, and one thing that we take pride in is actually our low tuition. And those tuition were low because of the previous governments were forced to make such choices, and the Quebec society as a whole chose to increase accessibility to higher education and not to make that commodity only accessible for those who can pay.
Now, tell us about the Quebec government. What are their politics and who are the personnel?
Well, the Liberals have been in power for 9 years now, and they really prefer the right-wing agenda. We talked a lot about the tuition hike, but there's a lot of other measures. For example, they're also putting a healthcare tax on every citizen in Quebec. So now in order to access the healthcare system, you have to pay a $200 tax. I know for the U.S. this might seem kind of a good deal, but for us, where in Quebec the healthcare system has always been free, it's really kind of a shift in the conception of healthcare and public services as a whole. So, and there's also the fact that a lot of people in the Liberal government have been accused of corruption, and they've been a part of several scandals now in the last year. So a lot of people felt that it's kind of ironic to being told that the government doesn't have any money to pay for universities now, and then he has to raise tuition, where there's millions, maybe billions, wasted in corruption every year, especially in the construction industry.
The reason that tuition is so low in Quebec is provincial funding. How are the universities financed? Are they provincial or federal or a combination of them?
It's a combination of both. What happened is normally education is a provincial competence. I'm not sure of the word in English, sorry.
We'd say responsibility, I think.
Yeah, responsibility. But for higher education, the federal government gives funding and has some specific programs. But the main part, the university in Quebec are financed by the provincial government. And you also have, the tuition hike does pay a little bit, a piece of the funding of the university. And you have also philanthropy and that kind of other stuff, like the private donations and foundations of the university themselves.
What connections between the students and other social sectors have there been during the struggle over the recent months?
Well, we tried to bring. Well, there have been a lot of connections between teachers' union and unions in university and colleges. A lot of teachers, professors were really TAs were really supportive of the strike movement. So they went. Some of them joined us on the picket lines when we were facing police. Besides of that, we also created links with unions as a whole, the three major union federation in Quebec. We also have linked with the Occupy movement. Occupy Montreal was pretty strong last winter, and a lot of them actually joined the movement when the student strike became more kind of a social crisis and a fight against, maybe you've heard about it in the U.S., Bill 78, which is a bill implemented by the liberal governments which restrict freedom to protest and with thousands of dollars in fines. So
yes.
People joined us after the Bill 78 was implemented. A lot of people joined us in the street, and that's when you can say that the student strike became more social crisis.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. The response of the police and the legal system has been quite severe to these disruptions, right?
Yep. Before Bill 78, the response from the government has always been to ignore us from mid-February until the end of March. At the end of March, things got a little more hectic as a lot of students were putting forward economic disruption action. So people were blocking bridges, blocking the port of Montreal, blocking railroads, that kind of stuff. So blocking the subway, the metro system. So a lot of police repression went after the people who did those kind of actions. And eventually, as I said, the government enacted Bill 78, and that's when really we saw a lot of violence, even more in the streets. People took the streets, but they were illegal against Bill 78, so the police tried to arrest them, and there was really a lot of violence on both sides of the fence. Yeah, also Bill 78 has been criticized by the bar in Quebec, by several organizations. For example, the Human Rights Commission in Quebec said it believes it's unconstitutional, and even the UN Human Rights Watch Committee said that the Bill 78 was dangerous to freedom of speech and freedom of protest.
I want to get back to the organizational questions, because you know, in the U.S. we've had a tradition of spontaneity among a lot of student organizations in the Occupy movement, and a suspicion of more formal modes of organization. The unions you described from the campus level and also at the provincial level sound like the student movement is not afraid, at least to some degree, of institutional development. How important were these unions to the to the development of the movement?
I think they were essential. Why the strike got so big, I think one of the reasons why the strike got so big and went was because of the presence of unions, of students' unions. Students' unions have been established in Quebec for now more than 50 years. They started around in the 60s. And they always kept, it depends, you have some higher, sometimes where the mobilization is higher and a lot of people get involved in their union, and sometimes things go slow down and there's less people involved. But even then, there's always been a core of students involved in their union. And the unions have always been very democratic. Well, at class, we really take a pride in having unions run by the members. So what happened is usually that you have the general assemblies of the students' union where all the important decisions are made. For example, the decision to oppose tuition hike as a students' union were made in general assembly. The decision to go on strike or not were made in general assembly. And every week or so during the strike, students will meet in their general assemblies to decide if they want to continue or not the strike, to vote on some action they want to take against the government and everything else. So those general assemblies really are important for the movement because it's there that all the strategies and all the plans, if you want, are made, and everybody feels that it's their movement, so they get more and more involved in it.
The votes were majority basis or consensus, or what was how did the votes work?
Majority basis. We have a set of rules similar to Robert's rules, if you want. And, it's basically based on the idea that it's the majority who wants. There's a lot of discussion and debate, but eventually it comes down to a vote, and it's a majority vote to decide on the important stuff, for example, the strike or the opposing tuition hike.
I'm speaking with Hugo Bonin, who is with CLASA, the Federation of Student Unions in Quebec. And now the relations with the labor unions. In the Occupy movement in the U.S. And you know, student movements in the U.S., there's a good deal of suspicion between on both sides. Unions, labor unions, are not always comfortable with student and Occupy types, and vice versa. What are the relations like in Quebec?
I think it's similar, but it depends. For, at the local level, as I said about the teachers' union and the unions on campus, there was a lot of support and a lot of solidarity, and you know, people organizing action together. But on the more Quebec-wide level, the Federation have been supportive against tuition hike, inviting their members to our demonstration. But at the same time, they're playing kind of this card that they know better and they can act as a in between the students' representative and the government and help with the negotiation. So they have kind of this attitude that they want to help us, but at the same time, they think they know better what to do than we do. But as I said, on the local level, we saw a lot of solidarity, and even sometimes in Alma, which is a town in Quebec, there was a lockout at Rio Tinto Alcan, and the students went up there to have a protest and so support the workers over there. We had some layoffs in Aveas in Montreal, so we went also there to show support. So there's really been, we tried really at the local, on the ground, if you want, to create more links and more build more relations for the future and even as a part of the struggle.
And then what about with the electoral politics?
We're in election right now. So it really affected the mobilization. For example, maybe I'll give an update right now because I don't know if you heard in the U.S., but what happened basically with Bill 78, the winter semester was suspended for all the students on strike. And so what happened is that the winter semester is going to end in August and September, and everything, the rest of the calendar is going to be pushed back and rearranged and everything. And so students in CGEPS and universities are, you know, if you want, coming back to class during this month. So what happened last week in the last 2 weeks is that we took some new votes to see if people wanted to continue the strike or not. And with the election campaign beginning, which began at the beginning of the month on the 1st of August, basically what happened is that everybody went into their general assemblies and said, well, we are now in an election period, so we should stop the strike and go vote, and that we'll hope to kick out the Liberals and we'll win that way. So I think the election basically kind of killed the movement because most of the student strike vote have failed by now, and people are going back into their classes. There's still a couple thousands, tens of thousands on strike. But it's probable that after the election, everybody's going to go back to class.
So what happened with tuition increases? Are they still on hold, or are they gone through?
Well, the tuition hike in itself is still part of the budget, but then it's supposed to enter into effect on the fall semester. But with the elections, the Parti Québécois, which is the main opposition party, promised that if they are elected, they'll freeze tuition and actually have a summit, if you want, on post-secondary education, on higher education, to talk about all the tuition and see if we really want to raise it or not. So a lot of people, a lot of students in the General Assembly said we should vote for the Parti Québécois, and if they are elected, the tuition hike will be canceled. So we will kind of win on that side.
Is there distrust of the PQ as being a threat to the autonomy and militancy of the movement?
Well, we at CLASS, we think that it's not through the ballot box and through political parties that we can find a solution to that, because the PQ was in power in the 90s and in 96 tried to raise tuition by 30%. So we see that's not really, it's not about the party, because when once they're in power, they always want to do kind of the same thing. But maybe we couldn't get that message across to students, because a lot of them felt that it was still voting against the strike and vote on the upcoming election is the best thing to do. But we think that it's true. Our mobilization, even if the Parti Québécois is elected, we think it's really through our mobilization and through taking the streets, having been on strike, that we actually get the PQ to cancel the tuition. Because before the strike, the Parti Québécois was not really against tuition hike and wouldn't take a firm stance against it. So by going on strike, we actually forced them to do so.
And when is the election?
September 1st.
Is the PQ likely to win the election?
I'm not really following the campaign actively, but from what I've seen, there's rumors of having a PQ government, but minoritaire. I'm not sure in the word in English, sorry. Like, they wouldn't have the majority of the seats. They would have to kind of rule with the help of a second party.
A minority government that would have to be in coalition.
Yeah, a minority government. So, yeah, kind of like we had in Canada at the federal level with the Conservative, with Harper. But the campaign is not done, but for now it looks like one of the possibilities.
So what do you suspect the student movement will do after September 4th?
Well, a lot of students actually stopped the strike, but decided to have another general assembly to talk about the strike after the election. So we'll think that actually whoever is elected, our best way to block the tuition hike is really to keep on mobilizing. And if students feel that going back on strike is the right way to block the tuition hike, well, we support that choice. So I think it's hard. It's really hard to tell what will happen. It really depends on the election and on the students themselves. But I think whatever the party is elected and whatever if students continue to go on strike, a lot of seeds were planted this spring, and we might see some of them grow into the following month. A lot of people were for the first time exposed to a discourse about direct democracy, having general assemblies, getting organized and mobilizing. We also talked a lot about civil disobedience. And the fact that Bill 78, we think that Bill 78 isn't just, so we should fight it in the streets and in the court. And, I think that the movement, the strike this spring really changed the Quebec political landscape. And it might not be reflected on the if you wanted, the political party's agenda and the election. But I think for a lot of people, they're going to continue to get organized at their local level, whether that be in the universities or in the colleges or just in their neighborhood or in their workshop and in their factories.
And finally, did the student movement take positions on issues other than the tuition hike? Were there any other issues that got people in the streets or exercised solidarity with other movements?
Yes, actually, well, at class, we don't think it's tuition hike are part of our, the single issue. They're part of the broader agenda of the Liberal government, which is to increase tariffs and to actually cut free public services or tax-paid public services to really have a user fee, if you want, a user fee system. So we're opposing the tuition hike, but we're also opposing, as I talked earlier, about the health tax or other measures in that kind of spirit. But we also took position, the students in the General Assembly took positions on other issues, for example, feminism and the question of the right, the place of women in society has been really an important issue for the students in the strike, because we consider that tuition hikes are sexist because they're less paid than men. We'll have repaid the tuition in more time and we'll get more debt. But we also took, for the students in the draft, and we also took anti-racist position because the tuition hike is also affecting more people of color in Quebec. So we can see that's not really a single-minded issue. It's really about seeing the connections between different problems and different people in the Quebec society.
That's Hugo Bonin, who is with CLASA, the province-wide association of student unions in Quebec. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Igor Stravinsky's setting of the Bach Canon we heard earlier from Himmel Hoch, performed by the Boston Symphony under Seiji Ozawa. Till next week, bye.